for the title for this. I had a theme for a couple of weeks and took some time to come it together, but kind of come up with this title, Marking Humanity. So what we're gonna study here is that due to the fall, humanity is now marked in two ways. Either you're marked by allegiance to God or you're marked by allegiance to Satan. And these two camps of people have existed since the fall, and they will persist through to the end. And overwrapping this is the fact that God has given his created universe the freedom of choice, which is vital. And, it's so important and so ingrained that he was willing to die for us, to give us that freedom of choice. That's how valuable it is. And so the question I want to think about as we go through this study is, whose mark of authority do you want to follow? So with that, let's begin and take a look up at heaven at Lucifer. So back, God created heaven. We don't know when that happened. And is that not presenting? Sorry, it should be. There we go. Okay, now we're working. All right, good. I guess it's back there. So Lucifer's in heaven. He's a created being. The angels are created beings. And there was freedom of choice existed in heaven. This wasn't robotic control, this thing. But there was a divine patriarchy. There was a divine hierarchy. And there was this system of authority. And that power rested with God. And so, Lucifer was the highest created being. He held this top position underneath God. But over time, this seed of rebellion grew in him, this resentfulness, this arrogance, this narcissism grew in him, and he had desire to be first in power and first in authority and have rulership in heaven. So in Isaiah 14:13 it says, "For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north." So this is that spirit of enmity that Satan started to take on. And so he began a war for the mind in heaven, and it translated later on to physical war, which we'll speak to in a minute here. But this was a war of ideology, and it was a war against authority and power and against the established hierarchy that God had put in place. And, it was an argument that there is a better utopia, there's a better system, there's a better way to be than what God has established. And so over time, we don't know how long this went on, how long God allowed, Lucifer to go out and, whisper in the ears of the angels and share this. Did it cut out on my side, or? That's strange. Oh, let me pardon one sec. I think my laptop went to sleep on me. Let me fix that here, sorry. Pardon the disruption here, because we definitely can't have that. This technology stuff works until it doesn't, and then it really... Sorry about that. Hopefully we don't have to do that a second time. Okay. So this war of the minds went on, and then we fast forward to Revelation 12:7-9. It says, "There was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and neither prevailed. Neither was a place found in heaven for them. And that great dragon was cast out, the serpent called the devil, Satan, which deceiveth the whole world, war of the minds, and he cast out to earth, and his angels were cast out with him." So when him and his rebellious host were cast out, he took that rebellion and that self-seeking and rejection of God's authority, and he brought it down to earth. So what happened next here? So Adam and Eve were created with the same free will. That was kind of a core tenet of creating humanity. And God established this test of obedience, which we're very familiar with. And in Genesis 2:16-17, it says, "The Lord God commanded the man, saying, Of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, nor for in the day thereof you shalt surely die." So, given this test is there, and it's a choice of whether you're going to follow God and his authority or not. Well, time goes on, and we move on to Genesis 3:6, and it says, "The woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to desire to make one wise. And she took the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave it to her husband with her, and she did eat." So underlying that was obviously the conversation with Lucifer, and he questioned God's authority, and he spoke to her mind, like, you want to have wisdom, you want to have this something you don't have, something God's hiding from you. And so she came to that knowledge. He didn't physically put the fruit in her hand. He kind of, spoke to her and deceived her into it. And so at that point, when she took it, and then once again, she convinced Adam and he decided she was more important than God, that authority that God had given to Adam and dominion over the earth, it tells us he was given dominion all over created things, that was transferred from Adam to Satan. And Satan took over that dominion and authority over the earth here. So let us move along. So they're kicked out of the garden. Time passes, and a couple of sons are born here. And looking forward to Genesis 4, 3 to 7 here. In the process of time, Cain brought forth the fruit of God, fruit of the ground, as an offering unto the Lord. So the sons are born. They have two occupations. One's a shepherd, one's a farmer. God has instructed them in the way to worship. They've instructed him in his authority. And they're going through this exercise, pointing to salvation that they were given. So Abel, he brought the first thing of his flock and the fat thereof, which is what he had been asked. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and his offering. But unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto him, Why are you wroth, and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, would you not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. So the couple operative words there was, part of this was a question of respect. So God had given this, you know, this order. He had blessed Cain's efforts, but Cain thought, you know what? I've put a lot of time and effort into growing this fruit. I'm going to obey in part, and I'm going to do it the way I want to do. So in essence, it's a disrespect to God. It's rejection of what he's asked him to do. And, you know, obviously he must have been thinking about this for some time. The seed of rebellion came from somewhere. We don't know how, you know, Satan was obviously influencing that. But he had these thoughts and minds in his heart. And so, you know, Cain's bringing something to God that he had a personal interest in. And he almost is presenting it, you could conjecture, as a favor to God. Like, okay, you know, I'm giving you my first fruits. But it completely takes away the need for a savior, takes away the need for redemption. It's like, I've got it covered. I'm just going to acknowledge that you gave me this fruit, right? So that he's very angry, right? So what happens now? So some little period of time goes by. Once again, we don't know. And Genesis 4:8 says, Cain talked with Abel's brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field, Cain rose up against Abel's brother and slew him. So this anger, this resentment turned violent, and we have the first murder, first death of a human. And so the Lord came and said unto Cain, in verse 9 here, Genesis 4:9, if you'd like to follow along. And the Lord said unto Cain, Where is Abel thy brother? And he responds, Am I my brother's keeper? Which is, again, this startling amount of arrogance and disrespect that is going on here. If you're speaking to the creator of the universe, who you probably physically see, we don't know in a sense, you're having a verbal conversation, and you respond to this rhetorical, like, I don't know where he is, so he's lying, showing just no remorse, you know, just unbelievable character traits that are being shown here. And the Lord responds and says, What have you done? You know, which is echoing again what he said to Adam, What have you done? Obviously God knows, but he's trying to spark some level of, you know, I guess, repentance or some remorse. He's trying to spark his conscience here. And he said, Your brother's blood crieth out to me from the ground, and now thou art cursed from the earth, which has opened up her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. And when thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto you her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth. So he pronounces this curse of Cain here. And then once again, Cain responds with zero conscience, zero remorse for this action. And he says to the Lord, My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from thy face shall I be hid. I shall be a fugitive and vagabond on the earth, and it shall come to pass that every one that findeth me shall slay me. So, I mean, again, this astonishing arrogance of a position that he would you know, reject the judgment of God, think that he should be in charge of that. You know, what authority do you have over me to place this judgment upon me, is essentially what he's saying. So obviously he has satanic arrogance there. And so the Lord, in his infinite mercy and love, he says, okay, you know, therefore, whoever slayeth Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark upon Cain. So, you know, this mark and this sevenfold power that was given to Cain, and we know, where is he getting this spirit? Where is he getting this rejection of authority? It's coming from Lucifer, obviously. So that leads us to the question, so what is the mark of Cain? How would you define this? So interestingly, there's some misconceptions about this, and there's been a historical premise, which actually apparently seemed to have started in the Mormon church, that the curse of Cain is actually black skin. And so, I don't know if you've heard that before, but I'll read you this from Wikipedia. You can go look it up. So here's kind of sets the premise here. The church's first president is talking about Mormonism. Joseph Smith and Brigham Young reasoned that black skin was a result of the curse of Cain or the curse of Ham, which we'll talk to in a minute. They use their beliefs in these biblical curses as justifications for slavery. And so Joseph Smith wrote a book in 1830 called The Pearl of Great Price, and he calls himself Joseph the Seer in this book, and it's a bit of a biblical retelling. And I'll just quote from what he calls the Book of Moses, chapter 7 here. It says, "And Enoch also beheld the residue of the people, which were the sons of Adam." We don't know what Enoch this was. "And they were a mixture of all the seed of Adam, save it was the seed of Cain. For the seed of Cain were black and had not a place among them." And so it commingles the curse of Ham later as a sermon at all. So obviously that's not the mark, you know, that's one of, you know, example of racism that's being brought up, you know, in a faith, which was completely wrong. So however, what I would position this is, and what we'll study here, is that the mark that Satan put on Cain was a mark of power and authority. And it was a sevenfold power. So with power comes authority. So if Cain was able to avenge himself seven times over his enemies, it's a lot of strength, a lot of power. So God allowed him to be the ruler over the evil people and over the good, because if he was a ruler over the, you know, if the good ruled the evil, then they would, you know, the evil people grew faster, they would wipe out the good people. You know, God protected them to some extent, but we see throughout history that Satan is given power over God's people to a point, even to killing them temporarily. In essence, God is allowing Satan to give the power and dominion that he stole from Adam and transfer that to Cain and his descendants here. And how do we know that the devil had this power even? You know, so in the final temptation of Jesus in Luke 4:6, it says, "The devil said unto Jesus, all this power will I give you," speaking of the kings of the earth, this ruling authority on the earth, "and the glory for them that is delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I will give it." So acknowledging he has this power. So the mark was not a physical sign, but rather a sign of authority and the power to execute it. And this was given to Cain. So let us, let me step aside so I can read this here. Actually, I'll go down here so my laptop doesn't shut off on me again. So an interesting quote from Signs of the Times here. "Two brothers, Cain and Abel, represent the whole human family. There is a marked difference in the character of these two brothers, and the same difference is seen in the human family today. Cain represents those who carry out the principles and works of Satan. Cain's class of worshipers include by far the largest number, for every false religion that has been invented has been based on the Cain principle, that man can depend on his own merits and righteousness for salvation." So it's quite a strong statement. So clearly, you know, there's a lot of religious application to this, not just, you know, temporal power structure, government, this sort of thing. So let's see where this, you know, where the seed of evil continues, this mark of Cain, how the seed of evil grows here. And so in Genesis 4:17, it says, "Cain knew his wife, she conceived and bare Enoch. And he built a city, and he called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch." So he was a builder, and he's establishing his evil kingdom. And so he got a wife from somewhere, you know, must have been one of the daughters of Adam and Eve, chose to reject God and go this way. And so time goes on. So this, I don't know if you can read this here, a little bit hard to read, but I basically wanted to show you a visual reference of from Adam and Eve, just simplistic, up until the flood, at least what genealogy we know, the two sides, the mark of Cain, the mark of God, and these are the two groups of people. And so Cain had an Enoch, not the Enoch that we know walked and talked with God, comes down to Lamech, and interestingly, the power of evil grows. So Lamech, it says, had, you know, 70 times 7 power to take vengeance. So this ruling power, this authority, this rejection of God grew to the point that it was so bad, man's thoughts were, you know, wicked continuously, and God had destroyed them all with a flood. Now on God's side, you know, this is genealogy, it shows us, we got Seth coming down to Enoch, who walked and talked with God, Methuselah, another Lamech, not the same one as the, you know, evil Lamech, so type anti-type there, we have the same sort of, you know, names and similar times, potentially. And then we have Noah and his three sons. So, obviously, when the flood happened, sin didn't stop there, right? This mark of authority, this mark of Cain didn't die out with the flood, and it continued. And so, where did that continue? Where do we find that? And so, that seed of evil, that mark of Cain, was in the ship, was in the ark. And, you know, maybe it was one of, you know, a wife of Ham, we don't know, but we know where the seed came from, and it was Ham. And so how do we know that? Let's look at Genesis 9:20. And it says, so this is after the flood, and Noah began to be a husband, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank the wine, and he was drunk, and he was uncovered in his tent. I'm in Genesis 9:22. And Ham, the father of Cain, saw the nakedness of his father and told his brethren without. So he had a total disregard for his father. He's like, oh, this is a joke. You know, he's doing this. And so Shem and Japheth, the other two sons, took a garment, laid it upon their shoulders, and went in backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were backward, and they saw not the nakedness of their father. Verse 24, and Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done, and he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. So here's another curse is placed upon a disrespectful, you know, son who is propagating the line of Cain here. And maybe not, the genealogy isn't there, but certainly propagating the same behaviors, the same lack of respect for you know, his father, heavenly authority, etc. So time continues, and we come to Nimrod. And Nimrod was the grandson of Ham and the great-grandson of Noah here. So let me just read this briefly. This is from Josephus, Antiquity of the Jews. So Nimrod, it was Nimrod who excited them to such an affront and contempt of God, mark of Cain. He was the grandson of Ham, son of Noah, a bold man of great strength, 7x power, 70 times power, and he persuaded them, the people with him, to not ascribe it their power to God. It was through his means that they were to be happy. It was as if it was through Nimrod's means that they were to be happy, but to believe that it was their own courage which procured that happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God. This is a key point here that we'll see. So we know that Satan's kingdom, the mark of Cain, this ruling, crushing authority, ultimately results in tyranny as a way to, you know, remove men from God, and as a way to bring them into constant dependence on his power, which he is getting from Lucifer. And he also said he would be revenged on God if he should have a mind to drown the world again, for that he would build a tower too high for the waters to be able to reach, and that he would avenge himself on God for destroying their forefathers. So we continuing this theme of this incredible arrogance, disregard for God's authority, built off of this power that his, you know, they're holding, that's coming from Lucifer. He's giving this power to them. And the idea that you can, you know, build a tower and get away from God's destruction and take vengeance, reach up to heaven and, you know, rip God from his throne. The same mark of Cain, you know, philosophy here. So time goes on, and we have another ruler that, you know, there's obviously lots in between, but here I just want to bring up briefly the Pharaoh and the Egyptians. So Tutmosis III was another ruler who was given great power over God's people, and he had an incredible arrogance and disrespect. And it tells us in Exodus 5:2, it says, "And Pharaoh said, 'Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go.'" So another example, here's an earthly ruler who has great power, thinks himself a god, and does not know God and is exercising this evil rule, this tyranny. Well, time goes on, and come to the time of Christ. Jesus is born. He comes and he's, you know, inhabiting, you know, in Israel there, and the ruling power at this time was pagan Rome. So they were, you know, we know from all our studies of prophecy, there were this great power. They ruled with iron, and they set up rulers over the provinces. In this case, Herod, or one of the Herods, the Herod that was alive during the time of Jesus, and he also had this incredible lack of respect, the satanic arrogance and desire to harm God, because Herod, we believe, you know, probably knew God, who God was, and he wanted to see a sign. And so in Luke 23:11, when Jesus is brought before him, you know, before he goes to Pilate, or he goes to Pilate, comes to Herod, and then he goes back, Luke 23 says, "And Herod with his men of war set him at naught, Jesus, and mocked him, and arrayed him in gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. And on that same day," this is Luke 23:12, "Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for they were at enmity between themselves before that." So it's very interesting. We know there's no unity in Satan's kingdom, right? It is built off of tyranny, fear, discord. But there's one thing that unites Satan's kingdom and the people he gives his power to, and that is a hatred for God, a rejection of his authority, and a desire to destroy God's people. And here we see this in, you know, in the way that Jesus was treated, both by the Romans and by Herod, who wasn't really a Jew, but he was ruling over the Jews at this time. So this mark of Cain, this actions continue here. So let's fast forward a little bit to the Dark Ages, which we know Papal Rome, you know, crumbled. Pagan Rome crumbled. Papal Rome takes over power during the Dark Ages, and they start to rule. And this is taken from a quote here from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 882. I'm talking about papal supremacy. "Papal supremacy is the doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church that the Pope, by reason of his office as Vicar of Christ and as pastor of the entire Christian Church, has full, supreme, and universal power over the whole Church, a power which he always can exercise unhindered, and that, in brief, the Pope enjoys by divine institution supreme, full, immediate, and universal power in the care of souls." It's quite a startling statement. You know, once again, a complete rejection of God, his authority, his hierarchy, and we see where this spirit is coming from, this idea that a man can take on this authority, but he's doing it because he has power to do it, and he's physically exercising it in the world. So that gives him, you know, the ability to do that there. And so we know that... in Great Controversy, it's speaking again about the Catholics, specifically the Jesuit system here. It says they are devoted to the overthrow of Protestantism and the reestablishment of papal supremacy. So, and then in Revelation 17:18, tells us the story of modern Babylon, which we see growing in power here. And it says, "The woman you saw in the great city is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth." So, Bible tells us, we've studied it many times, Satan has given his power over to this system, to earthly rulers, and they all sit at the same table, regardless of what side they're on, which philosophy they're pushing, what way they're playing the game here. So let's continue here to the U.S. here. We've studied about the U.S. in prophecy, but let's read Revelation 13:12. So we're moving a little bit closer to home here. And it says Revelation 13:11, "And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke like a dragon. And he exercised all the power of the first beast before him, and causes the earth and them which dwell in to worship the first beast whose deadly wound is healed." So here we have another earthly power, the final superpower that is giving, you know, this dragon-like power. We know where that's coming from. That's Satan that is behind that. And it is taking a position of rejecting God's authority and attacking God's people, and ultimately taking about worship and allegiance to God. So let's continue going back to what we started in heaven, this war of ideas, because we've seen, you know, for last, I think, probably since the 1800s, and 1844 was a fascinating year when all these different ideologies went out into the world. You know, we obviously have Ellen White, and then all that, we have Mormonism, we have Jehovah's Witness, we have, you know, all the, you know, spiritualism movement started, you know, all that. And then at the same time, these things are out there, and they're increasing the polarization. And the consequence of this war of ideas is very startling, and it's sending us towards, you know, a chaos that's unfolding around us as we speak, and has been for a while now. So, another interesting, fascinating thing about 1844. So, there's a philosophy that came out in 1844 that is very much in play today. And that is Marxism. And Marxism is the father of all other isms that follow after that: communism, socialism, whatever ism you want to choose, fascism. And Karl Marx wrote, like I said, the devil was busy in 1844. You know? So Karl Marx wrote a book, Evolution too, 1844. Karl Marx wrote this book, Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts. And this is a huge subject. You could study, you could read it nauseam on. I'm just going to give you the most macro summary on it here. But in a nutshell here, Marxism, the worldview, is that history is a never-ending series of battles between the oppressor and the oppressed. So let's think, what was the argument that Lucifer used? You're being oppressed by God. You know, there's something better. There's some utopia you can aspire to if you reject this hierarchy and this power structure. And then the belief that all the suffering humanity can be laid at the feet of that division where there's, you know, haves and have-nots. And now if you ID as oppressed, it gives you an instant moral stature and the opportunity to act on that moral structure. And some of the core tenets of this Marxist suffering, the oppressed laborers is how this was playing out, was victimhood, ingratitude, envy, vengefulness, resentment, and exploitation. So we've seen earlier where those themes were playing out and who was, you know, representing that, i.e. Cain, ingratitude. He was envious of Abel. He was vengeful. He was a victim. As humans, we know that because of sin, because of the fall, suffering is endemic in life. And, you know, there's always going to be poor people. There's always going to be this disconnect because it's a broken world. And though as Christians, you know, we have the responsibility to accept that voluntarily and, you know, work with it. In Luke 9:23, it said, he said to them, the disciples, "If any man come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me." So you have to set self aside. You can't reject the divine hierarchy and the authority that God has given. But then the question is like, oh, you know, these Marxists, maybe they actually had sympathy for the poor workers who are being oppressed and slaving away, right? And, you know, they're not really resentment that's successful, but we know from history, you know, that kind of from 1844 to the 1960s, that was clearly not true because you know them by their fruits. And what was their fruits of Marxism and all the other ideologies under that? Was hundreds of millions of people killed. So look at the Soviet Union, look at China, Vietnam, Cambodia, you know, we still have North Korea today, Iran. There's endless examples where, Marxism, you know, doesn't work. It's a false doctrine, and Satan's using it to kill millions of people and wreak absolute havoc and chaos on the earth. So by the 60s, Marxism, which was started, you know, Marx, it was this philosophical idea, it was being rejected for what it was because it could no longer be sugarcoated. You could no longer hide it. The Western world was awake to this and horrified by the results of it. So then we fast forward to a modern time, and we've got this wonderful tagline of postmodernism. And so what is postmodernism here? And so essentially this was an intellectual sleight of hand which enabled, you know, these Western intellectuals are coming up with these ideas inspired by Satan, I would premise, to continue their narcissistic, resentful, utopian visions. And they started crusading under a new name, which is postmodernism, and now more recently, identity politics. And in a sense, this is rejecting the authority of God and his design, all the fruit of this movement. It is a goal to criticize hierarchies. It's a goal to tear down, you know, everything that is established, and ultimately set things on fire and bring this destruction. So on the other side of this, we'd say that we have a country where generally, you know, most of the world, you know, we're unified in a purpose. We want to have good lives. We want to care for our families. We want to, you know, follow God, you know, or that, or there's some sense of moral responsibility. But what's been happening with this postmodern movement is a rejection of that, and it's causing a fragmentation. And when you criticize all these things away, ultimately you atomize society and it erupts in a violent chaos, and it's not an anarchic utopia. And so continue more of what happens, and then that brings us to more of a modern flavor of this, which is this whole Black Lives Matter movement, which we're seeing the fruits of is a lot of unrest. So it's obviously a very charged subject. You might say, oh, you're a white male talking about black lives, whatever, and say, well, you know, I'm a fundamental Protestant, I'm Jewish, I'm married to a Mayan Indian whose ancestors are spiritualist, I'm an Adventist, I love the Lord, I am not racist at all. Racism is absolutely a problem. Racism started, Darwin promoted racism. If you read, you know, Origin of Species, at the heart of that was, you know, this idea of racism. And ultimately, who's driving racism? It's Satan. And racism is a real problem, it is a real thing, and it's a lot, it needs to be addressed, but the question is this movement, this thing that the whole world's consumed with and is creating this violent chaos, what's behind it, and is it something that we should support? And, you know, even peripherally, I mean, you can tackle the issue of racism. And so let's take a look at it briefly. So Lady Patrice Cullors, she's a co-founder of the BLM movement, and here is a quote from her from 2015. And so I'll read her words here. The first thing I think is that we actually do have an ideological framework. Remember, it's a war of ideas, right? It's taking physical format, but it's a war of ideas. Myself and Alicia Graza, who was a co-founder, in particular, we are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists. We are super versed of sort on the ideological authorities. So clearly, just right from the horse's mouth, they're saying what they stand for, and we know what we just looked at in a very simplistic way what Marxism is, what the result of it is. So here's folks that are out there crusading under this, under the banner of doing good for people who, you know, rightfully are, have experienced racism and continue to, but this movement's not doing anybody justice, doing bringing chaos. And so another interesting thing, there's another found here, Melina Adula here, and she was in an interview recently, and she gave us a sense of where is she getting these ideas. We know where they're at, but it's nice to hear it from them, you know, so we don't conjecture. So here's what she said in a video interview. Maybe I'm sharing too much, but we, referring to her and her co-founder friends, have become very intimate with the spirits that we call on regularly. Each of them seems to have a different presence and a personality. You know, I laugh a lot with Waukesha. You know, and I didn't meet her in her body, right? I met her through this work, the BLM movement. So right there, I'm telling you, where is this concept, where is this whole thing coming from? It's coming from Lucifer. It's coming from the spirits. And how were these folks introduced to those? Through this Marxist ideology, which is the Luciferian doctrine, it's the mark of Cain. So not speaking against them as individuals, but they're learning this, they're being taught this, and they're putting this war in place. And so on their website, once again, you know, what are their objectives? Is it to dismantle racism and all this? Like, well, let's take a look at what a couple of their bullet points are. They want to dismantle cisgender privilege, you know. So if you're man and wife, you know, that's a privilege, that's a problem, right? Well, it's a divine institution. We want to uplift black trans folks, especially black trans women, okay? We want to dismantle the patriarchal practice, which is, in a sense, saying we want to dismantle the hierarchy that God has established. We're rejecting God's authority. We want to disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family. Well, it's not a Western prescribed family. Who prescribed the family in the Garden of Eden? God did, right? And we want to foster a queer-affirming network. So once again, an atheist lifestyle that rejects God. And so we see a lot of, you know, our Adventist church is making statements about this. NAD is making statements about this. And they're, you know, they were saying Black Lives Matter. Now they're sort of backpedaling a little bit. And there's lots of preachers taking various positions. And so I'd say there's a lot of people who are questioning. And this it's kind of an interesting article. I will not pass any judgment or opinion on it, but it's in the North American Division Ministerial Magazine a few days ago. It said, there are a lot of people who have questioned a Christian's ability to align with the Black Lives Matter movement because the organization's other values and agenda, not sure what the other ones are than what we've seen here, seem to collide with the worldview. So we'll leave that question aside, maybe something you should think about, study more, and decide. But the question is whether one implicitly pledges allegiance to the organization itself when they affirm that Black Lives Matter, and even granting the premise that Black Lives Matter promotes some very troubling values, there is some history in the Adventist system that can form the question of whether, you know, Christians and Adventists in general should pursue a common cause with other organizations, even if there's not total agreement about the values. So it sounds to me like an ecumenical union. And it's an interesting question I'll leave you with on this point of Black Lives Matter is should you partner and promote an organization, and even by their slogan, Black Lives Matter, in a sense, it's a racist statement because all lives matter, and we don't mean that in any disrespect. You know, we love our brothers and sisters of all races, and God does, and we're all equal, but this is being put out there. So, and it's a thing in the Adventist church, I think, something to think about and study more into, and because it's going to come up in your conversations with people. So just to close here, I know to wrap this up, once again, a big theme, and we're kind of lightning through it here. Let's look at Romans 13, 1-3. And it says here, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but God, the powers that are ordained of God. God is giving his power. Therefore, whoever resisteth the power, God's power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of power? And do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. So, doesn't say that we can reject earthly authority. You know, God gave Cain and his mark and his seed rule ability to rule. You know, there's lots of laws. As Christians, we are, you know, responsible to, you know, be moral and follow the laws of the land to an extent that we can within reason. But, you know, at the end of the day, the question is ultimately, which mark will you choose? Are you going to choose the mark of God, or are you going to choose the mark of Cain? And, you know, I'll speak for me and my family in Joshua 24:15. It says, choose you this day whom you will serve. As for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. So I hope that's my prayer for each one of you, that you will, you know, the world's spinning off its axis. Satan is raging. He knows his time is short, and he's amping up the chaos here and trying to bring about this synthesis, which will drive, you know, what we know are the end time events. And he's using competing philosophies and ideologies, and it's spilling out into real world events. And we need to pray for people. We need to, you know, meet them where they're at and have a spirit of compassion and love, and, you know, address the real heart of these issues and not put a wrapper on it that's been inspired by Satan. So with that, let us close with prayer here. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you again for this time we can meet together to study this incredible theme. We want to yield to your authority, set aside ourselves, allow you to be in control of our lives, and that we can have the power of the Holy Spirit, and that you will keep the devil and all his schemes and wiles and dangers away from us so that we can go out and share your light in an ever-darkening world. So pray for your soon return, and that each one of us can be a light to each other and to our community. In your name, amen.
The closing hymn is number 618. It's Stand Up for Jesus. And I don't think we can sing this song sitting down.
Stand up for Jesus, the soldiers of the cross. Lift high his royal banner, it must not suffer loss. From victory unto victory, his army shall he lead, till every foe is vanquished, and Christ is Lord indeed. Stand up for Jesus, the trumpet call obey, forth to the mighty conflict in this his glorious day. Ye that are his now serve him against a number foes. Let courage life for Jesus, stand in his strength alone. The arm of flesh will fail you, ye dare not trust your own. On the gospel armor and watching unto prayer, where duty calls or danger, be never wanting there. Stand up for Jesus. The strife will not be long. This day the noise of battle, the next the victor's song. To him that overcometh, a crown of life shall
thank you for your participation. You are dismissed.